This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. The arts community was saddened as we said goodbye this month to an arts icon. We remember George Rodrigue. The Louisiana State Museum has a new leader. We sit down with Mark Tullis. And if you're in the mood to talk jazz, we visit with pianist Ellis Marcellus. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. He was a world-renowned artist, known for painting Cajuns and Blue Dogs. The arts community said goodbye this month to George Rodrigue, artist, philanthropist, and native of New Iberia, based in New Orleans. He died of cancer at the age of 69. I had the pleasure of talking with Rodrigue in 2008 as a retrospective on his art was on exhibit at the New Orleans Museum of Art. Rodrigue was overwhelmed by the breadth of the exhibit. I'd like to replay that interview as we remember the painter who stole our hearts with a little blue dog.
A lot of people crying. A lot of people could not believe that this is so much a part of Louisiana, and it affected me the same way.
Cajun artist George Rodrigue is humbled by this massive collection of his artwork on view at NOMA, the New Orleans Museum of Art, a collection which focuses on his mission to preserve Louisiana's Cajun culture.
Well, I think when I first walked into the place and saw it all together, I realized for the first time I wouldn't have done this if I didn't grow up and wasn't born in Louisiana. It's about Louisiana more than it's about me, I think.
Rodrigue grew up in the heart of Acadiana, in New Iberia, born in 1944. He discovered a love for art while recovering from a childhood illness.
I was in the third grade. I had polio, and I couldn't walk for a year. And the first thing my mother did was bring me some clay, and a model with clay, different colors of clay. And I found out I could make things with clay. And then she bought me a paint-by-number set, and I started painting with it. I didn't like to follow the lines, but I liked to paint.
Rodrigue listened to his inner voice, continuing to paint outside the lines. He went on to study at the University of Southwest Louisiana at Lafayette, and then sharpened his skills in Los Angeles at the Art Center College of Design. But his heart was in Acadiana, and he wanted to paint what he knew, beginning in the 1960s with Louisiana landscapes and oak trees, which were very dark paintings.
You know, the trees are black. They're not green. You know, they are black. And when you contrast them with the light far away, it's really black. So the black represented a lot of mystery in Louisiana, a lot of unknown qualities. Swamps are black. Everything is dark and black with the hope of the future far away. And we're always striving for that future.
As the work evolved, Rodrigue began to add people to that landscape.
People came in probably 3-4 years later where I got comfortable with that landscape and saying, this is my Louisiana. The typical Rodrigue oak was that. But what would a person look like who was maybe back of that oak tree and decided to walk around in front? And I found all these folk tales and folklore and actually the history of the Acadians coming to Louisiana. So I started trying to create something graphically that really interpreted the history, meaning that the people were cut out and pasted on the landscape because the people were cut out of someplace else and pasted here and stayed here. So the edges of the people were very, very sharp, and they never touched the sky, showing that they were caught. The oak trees caught the people. And then the light from the people came from within.
Rodrigue's style developed, and Blue Dog entered the picture. It would be the spark that would ignite his career.
Well, Blue Dog is actually a Cajun legend. It's called Loup Garou. When I was a little boy, my mother would tell me the story, if you're not good today, the Loup Garou will come and get you tonight, like the boogeyman. And at the time, I was painting all the Cajun folklore, and I needed a model. So I had a little dog called Tiffany, and who had been deceased like 10 years earlier, and I modeled it a little bit after Tiffany. It was a nighttime scene, and there was a moon. And so the dog ended up a bluish gray. and it was a loup garou. Never thought anything of it. And I had a show in Los Angeles on Rodeo Drive, and I had about 10 loup garou paintings there with the other Cajun paintings, and I overheard the people talking about it, calling it the Blue Dog. And it changed my whole perspective of it. And what it allowed me to do is get out of the Cajun motif, or Louisiana motif, and do something that was truly unique. I could use this as ways to come in on life today. And that's what really the Blue Dog is where are we today? And the dog is looking at us, and we're looking at the dog, and we're looking for the same answers.
You'll find the bewildered Blue Dog popping up in many of Rodrigue's themes. The exhibit is arranged in several sections, including landscapes, portraits, Cajuns, Blue Dog, Hurricanes, which are abstract spherical works produced 2 years before Katrina, and Bodies, Rodrigue's latest series.
It's nude figures that come from my art figure drawing classes. And the idea is you do a painting of a figure itself, and you photograph it, you put it in the computer, and you generate an inkjet print. You know, so you can change the color, you can make it a blue nude, you can make it a green nude, you can multiply it, and actually threw in a Blue Dog once or twice. And the dog is bewildered. Why is it with all these nudes?
George Rodrigue is constantly pushing the envelope. You were listening to a 2008 interview with world-famous artist George Rodrigue. He passed away on December 14th. George Rodrigue will be missed. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. Voices of the Arts is a partnership with NOLA-V and WWNO, featuring 8 new leaders of the city's foremost cultural organizations. New Orleans arts institutions have perhaps never gone through this kind of major change all at once. We're hearing from these new executives on what they bring to New Orleans, how they are embracing our culture, and their plans for the future. Today we hear from the man at the helm of the Louisiana State Museum.
My name is Mark Tullis. I'm the Assistant Secretary for the Office of State Museums under the Department of Culture, Recreation, and Tourism, but I'm also the Director of the Louisiana State Museum System. And I've been here for about 8 months now, and I come from UL Lafayette, where I directed the Hilliard Museum of Art for about 10 years. I always thought I understood New Orleans. I was born and raised in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and went to Baton Rouge High and LSU. But, you know, we would come here as children and as young people to visit and have fun, and I always thought I understood the city. Well, I think you could live here all your life and never really understand New Orleans, and that's part of the mystery about this city is it keeps people enchanted, and you're always discovering something new. I tell my wife I went through a transformative period after assuming this position. My wife was still working for the university in Lafayette, fulfilling her contract there. So I had to live 6 months in one of the apartments in the Batalba. And talk about a baptism by fire and noise and culture, food, and music. That really does it for you. I have to say that really defined New Orleans for me, that 6 months experience living in the Bucure. When this opportunity arose, a lot of people encouraged me to apply for it, and I began to realize I've been prepared for this for a long time. I don't want to get mystical on you, but I couldn't help but begin to think, you know, maybe this is where I should be. And that's one of the things that's interested and enchanted me most about this opportunity, is that I really get to do something for Louisiana that's given me so much. I think I'm really excited about the campaign for the Louisiana Jukebox exhibition will be monumental. But the exhibition itself will cover all genres of Louisiana music, not only jazz and blues and soul and rock and roll, but anything that was developed on the front porches or in the churches or on the riverbanks of Louisiana, we're going to share with the world. My hope, what I share with people all the time when I'm talking about this exhibition, is I would love to get on a plane after we've opened this exhibition, coming back to New Orleans, and ask the person sitting next to me, well, what are you going to do when you get to New Orleans? Usually the pat answer is, well, I'm going down to Bourbon Street and or, you know, something of that nature. I would love to hear someone say, well, I'm going to the U.S. Mint, and I'm going to see the wonderful music exhibition, and then I'm planning to go to some jazz clubs down on Frenchman Street. That, to me, would be a wonderful result of our efforts. One of the things that's kept me in this profession, and I think the thing that I still value about my opportunity to serve in museums is that wonderful moment that individuals can have to connect with an object. There are special types of epiphanies you have in museums, and there are special types of conversations you can have with other people around very important and significant things that represent either a value or historic places, your life in a historic context or your world in a historic context. So seeing people enjoy and grow and develop and come to these realizations in museums, I think is what keeps me coming back to work every day.
You can find out more about Mark Tullis's plans for the Louisiana State Museum at wwno.org or nolav.com. The pantheon of great New Orleans musicians is an extensive one, and there is no doubt that pianist Ellis Marcellus holds a richly deserved place in its upper echelons. His accomplishments as a musician and educator are of the highest order. WWNO's Fred Kasten recently interviewed Ellis Marcellus for the New Orleans Jazz National Historical Park's Talkin' Jazz live interview series at the Old U.S. Mint and talked with him about some of his formative experiences growing up in New Orleans and the Jefferson Parish community of Shrewsbury.
I was born in New Orleans, and after I was about 10, my dad bought some property in Jefferson Parish, and we moved to Shrewsbury.
In Shrewsbury, which is just upriver from the Orleans-Jefferson Parish line, Marcellus's father, Ellis Sr., who'd grown up in Summit, Mississippi, had room to keep some farm animals.
He was in the barn area, and he was milking his cow. So he told me, he said, go over there and get that feed and put it in a trough for the cow. So I got the bucket and put it in there. And I was kind of leery about this because, see, I was can't come from the city. You know? And like I was easing up on the trough to put it in. And the cow turned her head, which at the time I didn't know it, but she could smell the food. And she turned her head. I thought she was coming after me with the ball. So I dropped the bucket and ran. But eventually, I did become acclimated to just about all of the farm animals we had.
And soon got started with music, clarinet first, thanks to the inspiration of Artie Shaw and the Gramercy Five, and also some piano lessons. Marcellus enjoyed clarinet, but
the music of the day was primarily rhythm and blues. Mm-hmm. And so I got my folks to buy me a tenor saxophone because that was the instrument on the recordings that got most of the solos, you know. Like Lee Allen, who was with Fats Domino, and there was a saxophone player named Batman, and he was playing with Roy Brown, who had a big hit on Good Rockin' Tonight. Yeah. And I learned that solo. And basically, that was the direction that I went in because I realized that when I started to learn those solos, that I could get girls to look at me.
There's no art without sex, ladies and gentlemen.
So I went in, you know, moved into that direction. But around that same time, there was a radio show in New Orleans. I can't remember the title of the show, But the disc jockey, I think his name was Richard Rising, and he played modern jazz, you know, at that time. Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie. Right. And it was appealing to me. I didn't know what any of that really was. I knew I liked it.
Yeah, it just sounded good.
Right. And around that same time, around the spring of 1949, Dizzy Gillespie came through New Orleans with his big band. Hmm. And I heard, when I went to the concert and I heard that band, ooh, I knew that's what I want to do.
And it was around that time that Ellis Marsalis, playing tenor sax, picked up his first paying gig, thanks to his friend, pianist Roger Dickerson.
We had a rhythm and blues band, you know, called the Groovy Boys. Boy, that's a corny name. I think how that really came together, a friend of mine, Roger Dickerson, who is still in New Orleans right now, he was studying piano, and his piano teacher wanted to treat her students to like a, you know, a dance, a party, like. So she asked Roger about getting some guys together to play for them. At the end of the evening, which was quite a surprise, she passed the hat and collected some money and paid us, because we didn't expect to get paid. We were just having fun.
Having a good time.
So that was the first job that I ever played where we got paid, and it was $1.50 apiece. Which, you know, this was in what? 1948, 49, somewhere around that.
You're 14, and, 15 years old, something like that.
Yeah. And like, that wasn't too bad for somebody who was still living in their folks' house.
The Groovy Boys played school dances and the like for the next 4 years or so. Marsalis and Dickerson were eventually taking down $8 a pop. But Ellis also kept his hand in on piano.
I had started to study the piano with piano teacher named Gene Costin Maloney, who my sister was studying with, and I learned from her how to practice the instrument. It had nothing to do with any genre of music. It wasn't like jazz, classical, or whatever, even though mostly what I had to practice would be considered classical music, but she had a much broader mind. Like most of the piano teachers, you couldn't even touch their pianos and play jazz on it.
Right.
Yeah, it was sacrilege. But she was a little different. She believed that you should learn to play this instrument and apply that to whatever direction that you want to go in.
Ellis Marsalis' conversion to full-time pianist was essentially completed when he was sitting in on keys one Sunday night at a Dewdrop Inn jam session.
I heard this saxophone player named Nathaniel Paralot. And this guy was so good until I actually stopped playing just to listen to him on the bandstand. But I said to myself, I said, well, I will never play the tenor saxophone again. And I never did. You know, I put it in the case, and that was it. So then I started to reconstruct all of the information that my second piano teacher had given me, and actually started to work on the instrument and learn a lot more about it.
Boy, did he ever. You can catch the great Ellis Marsalis most Friday nights at Snug Harbor Jazz Bistro, and it is always a beautiful thing to hear. For 89.9 WWNO, I'm Fred Kasten.
Fred's interview with Ellis Marcellus was made possible in part thanks to support from the New Orleans Jazz National Historical Park. We round out now with a little holiday cheer from Satchmo. Christmas time in New Orleans.
Magnolia trees at night, sparkling bright. Fields of cotton look wintry white. When it's Christmas time in New Orleans. A barefoot choir and prayer fills the air. Mississippi folks gathering there, 'cause it's Christmas time in New Orleans. You see a Dixieland Santa Claus leading the band to a good old Creole beak. Golly, what a spirit! You can only hear it down on Basin Street. Your cares will disappear when you hear, hallelujah, St. Nicholas is here. When it's Christmas time in New Orleans.
That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go Inside the Arts. Wishing you and your loved ones a Merry Christmas. I'm Diane Mack.
I lead the band to a good old Creole beat. And golly, what a spirit! And you can only hear it down on Basin Street. Your kids will disappear, and when you hear, hallelujah, old Santa is near. When it's Christmas time and New Orleans. Yes, when it's Christmas.